It has not been a good month for professional sports officials. Major League Baseball umpires have faced passionate criticism from fans for several glaring mistakes during the playoffs. In college football, some officials were suspended after bad calls in a game last weekend, and the NBA locked out its already maligned referees in a contract dispute. Well, this sounds like a good starting point for our regular Friday discussion with sports commentator Stefan Fatsis. So hello, Stefan.
Hey, Michelle.
First off, are we seeing a trend here, a perceptible decline in sports officiating?
I doubt it. When people criticize referees, it's usually just fan and media overreaction. And yes, look, some of the calls we've seen lately have been bad, especially that incredible play the other night where the Los Angeles Angels catcher clearly tagged two Yankees standing off of third base, but only one was called out. But you have to understand, training, experience, performance review, they are more extensive than ever in sports. If there's an issue, I think it's how the games themselves have changed and how technology has changed and how sports can respond to those changes to try to make officiating even better than it generally is.
Well, speaking of change, one thing that's definitely different in baseball and football particularly, athletes just seem to keep getting stronger and faster. Is it that the refs just can't keep up?
You know, I think that's a conversation that's worth having. These sports are played at the remarkable speeds, and refs rely on human eyesight, reaction time, which aren't perfect to begin with. Officials in Major League Baseball, basketball, football, they're typically in their 40s and 50s. Some are in their 60s. The NBA, until recently, had a ref in his early 70s. Now, these guys are trying to, and I say guys because they mostly are, these guys are trying to govern sports played by people at least 20 or 30 years younger. Experience does matter. How you handle players, coaches, situations. The question is whether someone in his 50s or 60s has the physical ability to keep up.
You know, the refs take a lot of pride in what they do. This has to be a very touchy subject for them.
Yeah, and it was an issue in the NBA's negotiations for a new labor contract with its referees, who, by the way, are expected to be back on the court for the start of the regular season on Tuesday. Referees' unions have argued that leagues are looking for ways to fire older refs, who, of course, make more money than younger refs, on the grounds that they aren't as good anymore. This is dangerous territory. In the early 1990s, the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission found that the NFL had illegally demoted a referee when he hit age 65, and sued the league on the ref's behalf. That case wound up settling out of court.
But it sounds like this is not just about age and experience.
No, it's not. It's about the games. It's about the interpretation of the rules. Basketball is the best example here. A few years ago, the NBA instituted rules changes that were designed to speed up play and unclog defenses by discouraging contact between players. That sometimes led refs to calling fouls on every little bump, which slows down play, denies athletes the chance to show their ability to just play the game, which was the point of the rules changes in the first place. So more rules can lead to this subconscious reaction on a ref's part to enforce more tightly. That can lead to more calls, and thanks to the help of multiple camera angles and replays, more obviously wrong calls.
And replays, that seems to be a key word. If sports used more of them, would the officiating improve?
No, the question is whether the games would take longer, but whether you oppose or support replays, the reality is that it's here and it's going to keep increasing. The NFL has its extensive system. The NBA is adding a couple of new situations this year where replays can be used. You know, baseball's been much slower to find uses for instant replay. Right now, only to determine whether home runs actually leave the field. It's on the defensive. It didn't address the replay issue after this spate of bad calls. It did say it would assign only umpires for the World Series who would call the World Series before. Can duck it for now, but I think instant replay is coming even in baseball in some limited form, and I think it's going to come pretty soon.
Thanks, Stefan. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michelle.
That's Stefan Fatsis. He talks to us on Fridays about sports and the business of sports. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris in Washington.
And I'm Melissa Block at NPR West in California. It's been a week of long lines and frustration as swine flu spreads across the country and a lot of people who want the vaccine can't get it. We're going to hear about some of those frustrations and about widespread school closings. We begin with NPR's Joanne Silberner, who's in Atlanta. That's home of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And Joanne, what's the latest you're hearing from the CDC?
Well, the big issue this week has been vaccine availability. Tom Frieden's the head of the Centers for Disease Control, and he talked about the vaccine situation today at a press conference, and the very first thing he said was that while vaccine availability is increasing, it's increasing far too slowly, and he said it was very frustrating. And there's a second issue, which is how quickly the virus is spreading. He talked about that today, too. And also the Department of Education put out a report saying there's twice as many kids out of school today as there was yesterday. It's still a really tiny percentage of the number of students, but the point is it's growing.
And when Tom Frieden talks about the vaccine availability increasing but far too slowly, why is that? What's going on with the production?
Well, first let me say it became available before anyone expected, a couple of weeks early, but the production is slow. And the problem is the vaccine virus is growing slowly. And for reasons that are known only to the virus, it's just not as fast as others. There are some viruses that grow quickly, some slowly, and this happens to be a slower one. Some manufacturers are doing a little bit better than others. It's not anything to do with safety. It's just how quickly this thing is growing in culture.
You mean for the manufacturers themselves?
Right.
Well, how much vaccine is out there right now?
Well, as of Wednesday, it was 14.1 million doses. Now, 11.3 million of that's already been shipped out to the states. The government at one point was aiming for 40 million doses by the end of this month, and that's clearly not going to happen. They're still saying that there'll be much more around in November and December.
But obviously, swine flu is here now. It's very widespread. Has it reached anything nearing a peak?
Well, how about if I tell you that next year? I mean, no one can tell when a peak comes until it's over. And even if it does start to slide down, even if there are fewer cases, you never know when it's going to come back. I mean, the flus do come back, rarely, but they do. I hate to compare this to the 1918 flu because that one was a deadly one, very deadly. This one is much less often a problem like that. But that came back twice after the first run-through.
Joanne, it has been a big concern for the government, convincing people that the H1N1 vaccine is safe. But we are now, as we mentioned, hearing about these long lines, people who want the vaccine and can't get it. How big a challenge is the safety issue for the people at the CDC?
It's a great big challenge. And there's a real irony here because the government officials are really trying to convince people to accept the vaccine at the same time. They're saying there's not enough around. The really big issue here is pregnant women because they're much more likely to have serious problems. They're six times more likely to die if they get infected. And in fact, today, three physicians groups, including the obstetricians group, just sent out messages to all their members saying to get their pregnant patients, to really urge them to get the vaccine.
Okay, NPR's Joanne Silberner in Atlanta. Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris in Washington.
And I'm Alyssa Block, hosting this week and next from NPR West, with a story today about a much-loved local institution in Portland, Oregon. A chain of grocery stores that everybody there kept raving about. Listen to shoppers Robin Johnson, Andy Kerr, and Helen Abernathy.
The staff is great. They're very welcoming, very helpful. It's just fun to go in there.
I used to go to Whole Foods all the time, but I like this place better. They just because they seem to have better service and selection.
The people in there are absolutely the friendliest in town.
It's New Seasons Market, and its slogan is, in fact, the friendliest store in town.
What can I get for you?
Can I get a pound of the chuck steak?
You most certainly may. How many people are you feeding?
There are 9 New Seasons stores around Portland. 2 more on the way.
There you go. I'll see you next time. Oh, it's my pleasure.
The store emphasizes local meat, sustainable fish, lots of local and organic produce, tagged with yellow homegrown labels. And one thing shoppers will tell you is they like that New Seasons is locally owned. It was started 10 years ago by Brian Roeder.
And we had a great garden this year.
We meet Brian Roeder at his Portland home. His front lawn has been torn up, turned into a vegetable garden. Out back, there are chickens. But we don't stay long at the house. Brian Roeder, wearing jeans and a green T-shirt, straps on a helmet and does what lots of people in Portland do. He bikes to work.
So I'll see you there.
We meet up again a few miles away at one of his New Seasons markets and start walking around.
We do lots of things differently. It's a little bit of an alternate universe here.
And on the shelves, you see right away what sets New Seasons apart from, say, Whole Foods or Trader Joe's.
I mean, this is actually an interesting aisle to go in right here just because it gives you a sense of what this store is all about.
Yeah, I'm standing here in the cookie and chip aisle, and I'm thinking I could be right now in a Safeway. I'm seeing double-stuffed Oreos on my right, Fritos scoops right. on my left.
Exactly. And then if you move down the aisle here, you'll see that it shifts and it goes into the natural foods brands, the Barbara's and the Newman's Own. And so that's a lot of what this store is that we know that people aren't perfect. And we know that people want to eat good food, but they also want their Doritos and they also want their Oreo cookies. We're not the food police. We want to offer what people want.
So Skippy peanut butter, Diet Coke, they've got that, along with the tofurkey.
We recognize the reality of what people's eating habits are, and we offer them lots of fresh, healthy choices. And we find that over time, when they try those things, they end up liking them more, and they move in that direction. So we think that we're a positive force for change by moving people in the right direction. But on the other hand, if you like double-stuffed Oreos, you like double-stuffed Oreos, and as long as you don't eat the whole box of them, and you have a couple of them for a treat, there's really no big harm in that.
Eat and let eat is how Brian Roeder describes his philosophy, with a few exceptions.
There's a few products that we say are iconic in their awfulness.
So New Seasons doesn't sell tobacco products or 40-ounce malt liquor, no industrial-raised veal, and no farmed salmon, which Roeder calls an environmental disaster. We are, after all, in Oregon, Salmon Nation. The prices? You do hear some shoppers complain about that.
We're trying to make this a shopping experience that's affordable for all sorts of people. We're trying to democratize quality local foods.
You think that's true? You don't think there would be people, you know, a tight income who would say, there's this incredible special at Safeway this week that New Seasons just can't match?
No, I don't think that's true at all. One of the things is that that may be that Safeway may have a special this week that New Seasons can't match for some products. And at the same time, New Seasons Market is going to have a special that Safeway can't match. People might spend more money here because they get tempted.
Besides what's on the shelves, New Seasons prides itself on its customer service. More than two people online, they'll open up another check stand. Don't like something? You'll get your money back, even without a receipt. You're a senior or in the military, you'll get a discount once a week.
I think that our favorite one, though, is our special request policy, and it's just the word yes. And so basically, we'll just do what people want.
Which could mean opening up all the jars of chocolate sauce for a customer to taste, so he can decide which one he wants.
True story. Absolutely happens all the time. There's a lot of stories like that.
As for the workers, there's no union. Brian Roeder says there's never been a request for one. Pay starts at $10 an hour. That's well above the state minimum. If you work at least one shift a week, you and your family get health coverage. The company pays 50% of the premium if you work under 20 hours a week. It pays 80% if you work more. And New Seasons does profit sharing with employees. 20% of after-tax profits go back to the workers.
Hey, my friend.
How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
As he walks through the store, Brian Roeder greets a lot of workers by name. Many have been here from the start. But as the company has grown from one store and 70 people in the beginning to 9 stores, 1,700 workers, and 25,000 customers a day now, it's harder to stay connected. And that's why if a customer sends an email to New Seasons, Brian Roeder will read it.
I learn things about what's going on in the company that I wouldn't know about if I didn't read these things.
Roeder is 55, and his connection with food goes way back to soon after he left home at 17.
So I graduated from high school at 7 o'clock, and I left Chicago at 7:30.
Hitchhiking. He was pulled west by a book.
My brother had given me a copy of Ken Kesey's Sometimes a Great Notion. And I read that book, and Oregon was like a beacon of hope for me as I made it through those last months of school. And so I ended up wandering out to Oregon.
To a little town outside Eugene, Oregon, where he did what people did in the early 70s, started a communal farm.
And it was called Mud Farm. About all we knew how to do was create a bunch of mud.
But eventually they figured out the farming thing. Brian Roeder moved on to start a natural meat market, ran a grocery chain, and then started New Seasons. Roeder is interested in the politics of food. He believes maintaining local agriculture is important to community security. About 40% of New Seasons products are locally produced. He thinks linking responsible rural producers and interested urban eaters is good for everyone, and that even in this economy, it can pay off.
It's 2009. It's the worst economic conditions that I've ever seen in all my years of being in business, and we're going to have our best year ever. And so I think that our business model is strong and sustainable, and the fact that we've made it through 2009, we haven't laid off one staff member, and so it's working.
Working, and he hopes a model for communities everywhere.
We don't want to be an alternative grocery store. We want to be the new mainstream grocery store. That's really what we're working towards. And I would imagine that almost anywhere, people want to go to a store where the people working in the store are having a good time, the people shopping in the store are treated respectfully, there's local quality food for sale, the prices are affordable. I mean, what's not to love about that?
What you got going on today?
A new movie opened today about the American pilot Amelia Earhart. She went missing in 1937 while attempting to be the first woman to fly around the world. Hilary Swank plays Earhart. The film is directed by Mira Nair and also stars Richard Gere as her husband. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The life of Amelia Earhart is so endlessly resonant, so rich in mystery and irony, that it's hard to forgive the makers of the biopic Amelia for getting her spirit dead wrong. The facts are all here, but the movie is a blueprint. It never breathes. It starts with a reporter firing a question at Hilary Swank as Earhart, a.k.a. Mrs. George Putnam, as she's about to embark on an around-the-world flight. He says, this is the first line of the film, after this around-the-world flight, Mrs. Putnam, are you going to give up long-distance flying? Welcome to biopic country, where every line's a billboard. After that, the film leaps back and forth between that flight, which of course was Earhart's last, and the years leading up to it. When Earhart passes over giraffes in Africa, she marvels, look how free they are, no schedules to keep. Then, in a flashback, she has to deal with schedules, with people who want things from her, like Richard Gere as the publisher Putnam, who begs her to marry him. I want to be free, George, she writes in one of many voiceovers from her letters, to be a vagabond of the air. The plane soars, sheep part in its wake, and Swank gazes in vagabond wonderment, remembering herself as a little girl on a horse in a field racing a prop plane. I had to fly, she narrates. It's the difference, she says, between a life of three dimensions and, quote, a life imprisoned in safety. The movie is imprisoned in safety. The script by Ron Bass and Anna Hamilton Phelan makes gestures in the right direction. It touches on the most modern aspect of Earhart's story, that from the get-go, the image of this would-be free spirit was marketed like crazy. Putnam functioned as Earhart's Madison Avenue Svengali, although the filmmakers can't bring themselves to condemn him. He's a tender father-slash-lover who just happens to want Amelia to make money. This is America, he keeps reminding her, and it's dollars that allow her to fly. But Amelia boasts some of the most horrific examples of biopic dialogue I've ever heard. When Amelia can't decide what to do about her adulterous love for Jean Vidal, played by Ewan McGregor, he says, just ask yourself. And Amelia says, I'm not sure who that is anymore. This is a very dull triangle, Amelia, Putnam, and Vidal, whose little son, Gore, is comforted by Earhart when he's scared of some tiger wallpaper. The conflict comes to a head when the three debate the safety of the final leg of that around-the-world flight.
The closest land west of Hawaii is beyond the range of the Electra.
She'll refuel in the air.
She doesn't have the flying skills.
She's taking bigger risks.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Don't be so proud of it.
I understand the danger, fellas. I've studied the route. What have you come up with?
This is Howland Island. It's halfway between Honolulu and New Guinea. There's no elevation, no trees. Hardly anyone knows or cares that it exists.
It would be almost impossible to spot from the air.
It's really tiny, like a grain of sand in 1,000 miles of nowhere. If you miss this island, you're out of fuel with 2,000 miles to go.
But I'll have Fred Noonan, the best celestial navigator around.
In fact, she's taking Fred along for the whole trip.
Giving up my little arrogance about Solo. Safety first, yes?
The navigator, Fred, is an alcoholic, played by Christopher Eccleston, who has more chemistry in his brief scenes with Swank than either Gare, who's trying to dampen his sex appeal, or McGregor, who jiggles his head like a parody of a handsome man. But then, Swank rarely has chemistry with other actors. In her best performances, she has a gift for pulling you into her characters' heads, for making their dreams almost tactile. She certainly transformed herself. I'm not sure if her teeth have been artificially enlarged or she's lost so much weight that there's nothing left of her but cheekbones and choppers, all sharp angles with a dash of androgyny. But the movie has no texture for her to play off. A director like The Hurt Locker's Kathryn Bigelow might have lightly fetishized the planes so that you felt in your bones why Earhart had to put herself in the air. But Mira Nair has no connection to this material. The only emotion is in Gabriel Yared's old-fashioned romantic score, which ladles on the strings. Apart from a great scene with a stout, throaty Cherry Jones as Eleanor Roosevelt, the only time Amelia even has a present tense is in the last 10 minutes, when Earhart is over the ocean and running out of fuel. What a horrible irony. The story of this great American female icon comes to life only when she's on the brink of death.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. One thing you can say about high school football, it is not an experience soon forgotten. Boys, mostly, on the cusp of adulthood, enter a world of danger and camaraderie and competition. Now, as part of our series Friday Night Lives, the story of a man whose high school football experience happened decades ago, but for him, it remains vivid and special, even though football has left a dark cloud over his life. Our story comes from NPR's Tom Goldman.
So where are we now, George?
Sacramento.
George Visgar is on a journey. He's driving his silver Dodge pickup truck from home, Grass Valley, California, to Stagg High School in Stockton. It's a trip 2 hours south and 35 years back to when Visgar was a star lineman for the Stagg Delta Kings.
I get goosebumps going down there every year.
Goosebumps, tears, laughter, it all pours out when George Visgar makes the journey back, be it in his truck or in his mind. Here's a guy who played in a college bowl game, who was a member of a Super Bowl-winning NFL team. But it's the stories about Stagg High that Visgar loves to tell with crystal clarity and passion, especially from his senior year, 1975. The story that trumps all is when the father of starting running back Fred Douglas was murdered the week of one of the biggest games of the season. The whole team went to the funeral on a Thursday. No one expected Douglas to play Friday, right up until the moment he appeared, minutes before kickoff.
And I'll never forget, he comes in the locker room and he's got his bag of gear over his shoulder, and all he said was, "I just thought you boys might need me tonight. I couldn't let you down." And I'm telling you, it's hard for me to even talk about it, you know, 35 years later. Without getting emotional, but there wasn't a dry eye in the locker room.
On show.
Visgar's eyes have dried by the time he gets to the Stagg High practice field to watch the 2009 Delta Kings. Not that it matters, because the players aren't looking in his eyes anyway.
Right.
Dang.
Right.
That's nice, bro.
They're ogling the rings on Visgar's left hand, one from the 1977 Orange Bowl when he was a starting defensive tackle for the University of Colorado. And the main attraction on his right hand, the diamond-encrusted 1982 Super Bowl ring when he was a member of the champion San Francisco 49ers.
It's got an ounce of gold in it.
Visgar puts on the rings for occasions like this. He's been asked to speak to the team after practice. His speech is laced with vivid memories of decades-old high school glory. The irony, the cruel irony, is when you spend time talking to George Visgar, you also get this.
And today, when I was at the, I think it was today, right? When I was at the Hydrus when I was at the TV interview. I'm trying to remember when it was today, right?
The interview.
Yes, thank you.
Laughter actually, is one coping mechanism for his dwindling short-term memory. Okay. The small yellow notebooks Visger stuffs in the back pocket of his Levi's are another.
So here's Monday. So there's Monday still.
The notebooks are George Visger's memory, a daily log of conversations that otherwise would be lost. It's just one of the symptoms of a brain battered by football. Visger's first concussion was at 13, pre-high school. His coach at the time had the players do a drill called Bull in the Ring. Two guys on opposite sides of a circle, a ball in the middle. First guy to the ball wins.
We just put our heads down and ran at each other full speed from 25 yards, you know. Top of head to top of head, which, you know, was crazy.
Young George Visger was knocked unconscious and hospitalized. By his estimate, he went on to have hundreds, if not thousands, of concussions during his 12 years playing football. Most not as severe as the first, but they took a toll. In the early 1980s, Visger says team doctors for the San Francisco 49ers told him his episodes of pounding headaches, projectile vomiting, temporary loss of sight and hearing were due to high blood pressure. Reached this week, the 49ers said it wasn't proper to comment since they have no firsthand knowledge of Visger's medical history. In fact, Visger had developed hydrocephalus, where excess fluid accumulates in and around the brain. It has led to 9 brain surgeries. The first one prevented him from playing in that 1982 Super Bowl with the 49ers. But he still got a ring.
Hey, fellas, I don't mean to bring the party down, but have any of you ever had a concussion?
No, sir.
We're back in George Visger's pickup. He's driving a few of the Stag players to their homecoming parade. Visger listens as Stuart Belil, an offensive tackle, acknowledges some symptoms, but not, in his mind, a concussion.
Like, when you hit someone, like, there's always, like, sparkly things if you hit them hard enough, and that's a pretty good feeling because you know you got them.
Well, those are mild forms of concussion now is what they're considering concussions. Back when I played, it was you're either unconscious or stumbling around. And
concussion education and treatment have improved since Visger's high school days. Stag players say they know the risk as much as teenage boys can know risk. Sean Mayo is a senior defensive end.
You love football, and it doesn't really matter what happens. Just go after it.
Just go after it. Man up. The kind of football attitudes that George Visger used over the years to shrug off his health problems. But lately, he's been worried. The symptoms have been getting worse. Not just his memory, but he's getting more easily distracted. It's taking longer to finish the reports he prepares as a wildlife biologist. And Visger's biggest fear, flashes of anger that are taking their toll on his wife Christy, a school teacher, and his young children.
And my wife works her tail off at school. She'll be there at till 10 or 11 or midnight sometimes. My kids are staying there with her now sometimes, almost that late. Chrissy's telling me now, well, they're afraid to come on with me.
This week, George Visger was in Southern California for an extensive brain evaluation. The news was not good. The neuropsychiatrist who studied Visger, Dr. Daniel Amen, says Visger's brain is damaged to such an extent that he'll get dementia in the next 5 years if they don't try to reverse his condition. Visger says he's extremely enthused about Dr. Amen's treatment plan, a combination of improved sleep habits, better diet, and the right medicine. Still, he admits a sense of urgency in accomplishing things now, like raising awareness about hydrocephalus, promoting concussion education, speaking on behalf of other NFL retirees with long-term health problems, and, of course, loving Stag High School football. Next month, he'll be back in Stockton cheering for some old teammates as they're inducted into the Stag High Hall of Fame. Tom Goldman, NPR News.